Welcome to the Deadcast.
Hello, in the gutters of New York City, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello, in the sewers of New York City, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of New York City, and from the ants that dwell in these cracks and feed on the dried blood of the dead that is seeped into these cracks. JB, I'm just dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in these recent and horrendous 44 killings. I also want to tell you that I read your column daily, and I find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Loria, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now, the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by cops with smoking 38s. Whatever. If I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam, and I will introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell, and I will see you at the next job. Or, should I say you will see my handiwork at the next job? Remember Miss Loria. Thank you. In their blood, and from the gutter. Sam's creation. 44. Here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the Inspector of Police by NCIC. The Duke of Death. The Wicked King Wicked. The 22 Disciples of Hell. John Weaver. Rapist. Suffocator of Young Girls. P.S. J.B. Please inform all the detectives working the slaying to remain. P.S. J.B. Please inform all the detectives working the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging. Drive on. Think positive. Get off your butts. Knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working on the case a new pair of shoes, if I can get up the money. Son of Sam.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we once again look at the Son of Sam case. I hope you enjoyed that dramatic reading of the Breslin letter as the trailer for this week's episode. Now, before we get into our case this week, I have our normal plugs. If you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, MeWe, and YouTube. You can find me under Ian Totten Author, the Facebook page generally dedicated to promoting my books as well as this podcast. Same with the MeWe. On the YouTube page, you can find video versions of the show. Instagram, it's a mixed bag of memes and true crime and book-related content. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple different ways you can do that. There is a Patreon page for this show. the lowest of which I believe it starts at $1.99 a month. So for just $1.99 a month, you can help support the production of this show. You can also like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Please, if you do so, leave a 5-star review. It really does help the show. Also, you can share the episodes of this show on social media with your friends, families, and anyone else who you feel might be interested. A couple of other plugs for friends of the show. First is the Booking the Territories Unprofessional Wrestling Podcast, hosted by Mike Mills, Doc Turner, and Hardbody Harper. They drop weekly on Thursdays. It's a very entertaining, if un-PC, show where they look back at old professional wrestling. Again, that's the Booking the Territories Unprofessional Wrestling Podcast. Another friend of the show is fellow best-selling author Alistair Cross. He and his partner Tamara Thorne, who's an internationally known best-selling author of horror, the two of them constantly have new novels, both collaborations and solo works, coming out. So you can find them Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible, wherever you get your reading fix. That's Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. Lastly, another good friend of the show is Grim Trickster. She's over on Patreon at Grim Trickster. She does some really cool stuff, some not suitable for work pictures that have a very macabre horror bend to them. I think you'll like them. Again, they're not suitable for work, but they're very unique. She's a very talented lady, so go check her out. Right now, the plugs are out of the way. Get yourself something to drink, sit back in a chair, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Okay, when we left last week, reporter Jimmy Breslin had just released the second communique received from the Son of Sam killer, and I talked about the symbol that the Son of Sam had put underneath his signature. Just two X's with a circle on one side and a circle on the other, and the cross arms that look like the male and female symbols. A cross in the upper X area of the symbol and an S in the bottom. Something interesting regarding this symbol is that according to journalist Maury Terry, the symbol actually had its origins with the 19th century occultist Eliphas Levi, and the male and female symbols were actually the astrological renderings of Mars, the god of war, and Venus, goddess of the Roman sewers, who was also known as Placida. And that last piece there about Venus is actually kind of significant if you buy into Terry's theory that a cult was involved in the Son of Sam killings. Because on Saturday, June 25th, 1977, Judy Placidio, who lived on Wickham Avenue in the Bronx, went to a discotheque in Queens named the Eliphas in the Bayside section of Queens. Now, according to Terry, the name Eliphas means elephant in Latin, and apparently has some significance in the cult as it stands for Behemoth, which, if you'll remember, was referenced in the letter to Captain Borelli. Now, by this time in the Son of Sam murders, fear was really starting to ripple through New York City's nightlife. the streets were really starting to get deserted. People were more apt to stay home. Women were reported to be getting their hair dyed lighter shades, as well as getting haircuts to shorten their hair, as the majority of the victims had long brown hair. Judy did not go to the disco by herself. Three other friends accompanied her as Judy was celebrating her graduation from high school. Somewhere during the night, she met a young man, 20-year-old Salvatore Lupo, who was from Maspeth, Queens. At around 2 a.m., Judy's friends decided that they'd had enough of being at the discotheque and made to leave. Judy opted to stay as she was having a very good time with Salvatore. Now, Salvatore had gotten a ride to the club that evening from a friend of his who worked there as a bouncer, and Salvatore informed Judy that his friend would give her a ride home as well. So it was decided that Judy would stay at the club while her friends left. Somewhere around 3 a.m., Lupo showed Judy the keys to his friend's car and said, you know, why don't we go wait for him until his shift is over and hang out in his car, which, you know, you can get what was implied there. Go out and talk and maybe make out a little bit. The car, a 1972 Cadillac, was parked two blocks from the club on residential 211th Street near the 45th Road intersection. Shortly before they arrived at the Cadillac, according to witness statements, another Cadillac had been seen in the area. This one was an older vehicle that was gold in color with a black vinyl roof and damage to the rear end, and this car had been seen cruising up and down the streets. Again, according to witness statements, a young man who was in his 20s or 30s with short black hair and a thin mustache was behind the wheel. Judy and Salvatore reached the vehicle unmolested and sat inside smoking cigarettes and talking for a short period of time. Without warning, shots rang out. The first one shattered the front passenger side window, hitting Lupo's right wrist before traveling on and hitting Judy in the neck. At this point, Lupo dove below the seats while Judy was hit again, this time in the head. Amazingly, the bullet really only traced along the skin of her head before settling in her right eyebrow. Judy was hit again, this time in the shoulder. Judy was able to get out of the vehicle and stagger down the street before collapsing. And it wasn't long before residents of the neighborhood contacted the police and went outside to see what had happened. Obviously, they'd heard the gunshots. They found Judy lying in the street. Somebody wrapped a blanket around her while a crowd gathered around her to make certain that nothing else happened. For his part, Lupo went back to the disco to inform them of what had happened before going back to stay with Judy. According to witness statements, a stocky white male clad in black clothing was seen running along 211th Street away from the shooting location. Another witness saw a well-dressed young man with sandy-colored hair and a mustache jump into a yellow or gold Chevy Nova-type car and leave the neighborhood with the car's headlights extinguished. A partial plate was able to be recovered from this vehicle. Unfortunately, though, it led nowhere. The vehicle is believed to have fled in the general direction that the running man was seen heading in. And the belief among police at the time was that this individual had been there to watch the shooting. And it was later uncovered that a similar car had been seen double parked at the Loria shooting, and that also it would be seen at the site of other shootings. Both Lupo and Judy survived their encounter with the Son of Sam, although neither of them were able to give a statement as to who had shot them, as their assailant had been unseen. This shooting really upped the ante in New York as the panic spread like wildfire. I'm gonna share a quick story that was recounted to me back when I was in high school. I was working a part-time job, and one of the women who worked at this job had moved there from Long Island. Now, anybody who doesn't know New York City, Long Islanders consider themselves New Yorkers. People in the city really don't consider Long Islanders as being from New York City proper. At any rate, there's quite a bit of distance between Staten Island and Queens. By that, I mean, you know, an hour or so, give or take, depending on traffic and other conditions. This woman that I was working with was recounted this story to myself and another guy who was at the company, that she was in her late teens in 76, 77 when the shootings were going on, and she was one of those who had cut her hair short and dyed it blonde out of fear that, you know, she might be in a car one night with somebody and would end up shot. And she and her friends had gone out that night over her parents, you know, protesting that the Son of Sam was probably out there. And while her and her friends were sitting in the car, a radio bulletin came on the news stating that the Son of Sam had struck again, and that police believed that this individual might be heading towards the Staten Island area. Obviously, this terrified the woman and her friends, and they immediately decided to cut their night short and head home. And I share this just kind of to illustrate the level of panic that was pervasive in New York City at the time. Nobody knew what was going on, where this person or persons was going to strike next. And just the mention of the Son of Sam killer, while obviously bringing with it a sense of morbid curiosity, was enough to make, you know, young teens fearful that they might be the next one and decide to, you know, go home and hide out rather than possibly risk the killer's wrath. The newspapers really started upping the ante as the anniversary of the Son of Sam's first shooting drew closer, with a number of papers speculating openly on their pages as to whether or not he would strike on that evening. There's been a lot of criticism levied at the New York media for its Son of Sam coverage, particularly the newspapers, with a number of FBI agents speculating that they are to blame somewhat for the Son of Sam's actions, as they goaded him on with their headlines and stories. In fact, the day before the anniversary, on July 28th, Jimmy Breslin put a column out entitled "To the 44 Killer on His First Death Day." Quote, "And somewhere in this city, a loner, a deranged loner, picks up this paper and gloats. Again, he has what he wants. Is tomorrow night, July 29th, so significant to him that he must go out and walk the streets and find a victim? Or will he sit alone and look out his attic window and be thrilled by his power, this power that will have him in the newspapers and on television and in the thoughts and conversations of most of the young people in the city?" But it wasn't just the media who really played up Donna Loria's shooting. The politicians and police also talked about it incessantly, wondering whether or not the Son of Sam would strike again. July 29th actually came and went without any incident, although Berkowitz is said to have penned a letter that Maury Terry would discover 4 years after Berkowitz was taken into custody. And in this letter, Berkowitz actually names himself as the killer. And I'm going to read this bit of a letter here. And supposedly Berkowitz actually wrote this on the anniversary of the first shooting. "This is a warning to all police agencies in the tri-state area. For your information, a satanic cult, devil worshippers, and practitioners of witchcraft that has been established for quite some time has been instructed by their high command, Satan, to begin to systematically kill and slaughter young girls or people of good health and clean blood. They plan to kill at least 100 young women and men, but mostly women, as part of a satanic ritual which involves the shedding of the victim's innocent blood. Warning. The streets shall be run with blood. I, David Berkowitz, have been chosen since birth to be one of the executioners for the cult. He who hath eyes, let him see the dead victims. He who hath ears, let him listen to what I say." I think it's fairly interesting that Berkowitz penned this letter while the killings were going on, and I say this because a number of people, particularly John Douglas, the famed FBI agent, has said that Berkowitz is full of it, and that it's all a ruse, he's trying to get attention. I disagree with Douglas. I think at this point in his life, he's concerned with two things, and that's keeping his name on people's lips and keeping the cash coming in. He's no longer an FBI agent, and pretty much he goes to the highest bidder. If a defense team hires him or a family hires him, he's gonna say publicly what it is that they want to have out there, and people buy it. So, sorry, yeah, he's done a lot of work in the field of serial murders, but to me, John Douglas is nothing more than a carnival showman at this point, just trying to make money and keep his name in print. And that goes double for this case in regards to the satanic cult theory, in that he insinuates himself into cases long after the fact, when he either participated or everything's been said and done about the case, he'll throw out his, weighty opinion on it. Again, that's just my opinion, but moving on, July 30th and 31st were two very important days in the Son of Sam killings, as it's when the last known shooting took place. I say it's important because a lot of stuff happened on these 2 days. Firstly, the Omega Task Force was out in numbers, canvassing the residential and disco areas of both Queens and the Bronx. There were roughly 300 officers assigned to the task force at this point. At around 8:45 p.m., Robert Volante and Stacy Moskowitz decided to go to a movie in Brooklyn, in the Bensonhurst area of Brooklyn, specifically on the Shore Parkway Service Road. A man and his wife were walking through the park, and after going back to their car, the man's wife discovered that she had lost her bracelet at the 17th Avenue playground. They went back to the park and were unable to find it, and at roughly 1:10 a.m. they were back in their vehicle, which was parked on the service road near Bay 16th Street. While they were sitting in their car, they saw a yellow Volkswagen Beetle pull up to the park's entrance and park, after which two people got out of the vehicle and walked into the park. This couple left shortly thereafter. However, they were not the only ones to witness this car. The area that they were in was something of a lover's lane, and despite what had been happening in the surrounding areas over the last year, kids are going to be kids, they're going to go do their thing, and I'm sure a lot of them figured that with so many cars parked that had people in them, the Son of Sam would not strike. Now, multiple witnesses saw this yellow Volkswagen Beetle parked near the entrance of the playground. This Beetle had a black racing stripe along its running boards and what the witnesses believed were New York City license plates. Inside the park, a witness sees a man standing on the parkway's green belt near the overpass. The man looks as though he's trying to go over the parkway to the esplanade near Gravesend Bay on the other side. The man is described as wearing sunglasses, dungarees, and a white shirt. He is carrying a brown paper bag, which it should be noted is an item previously associated with the Son of Sam. Numerous other people also see this man in the park at various areas, once by a hole in the fence near the overpass, later walking towards them off the parkway overpass, coming from the Gravesend Bay Esplanade. This individual walks back out of the park to the yellow VW and makes as though to get into it until he notices that he is being watched, at which point he goes back into the park. The man has been described as white, stocky, short. He's about 5'7" with dark, short cropped hair. This is the same man who is wearing the sunglasses and the dungaree pants. About 1:15 a.m., Tommy Zano, who was 19 years old, is in a blue Corvette parked with his date for the evening. He's on the opposite side of the street from the playground. At around this time, he hears an engine start up and sees a yellow Volkswagen drive by him. Not long after this, Robert Vellante and Stacy Moskowitz, who have finished their movie and gone to a disco, they drive over to this area where reportedly they had been earlier in the evening. They pull into an empty parking space three car lengths behind Zano and his date. Now, between 2:05 and 2:10 a.m., NYPD officer Michael Cataneo, who is on a motor patrol with his partner Jeffrey Logan, they turn off the service road two blocks from where Vellante is parked. This is over on Bay 17th Street. After driving for about a half a block, they see a cream-colored Ford Galaxy with a black vinyl roof parked slightly behind a fire hydrant in front of number 290 on the west side of the street. Now, apparently, Berkowitz saw what happened at this point, as he was in a courtyard between apartment buildings, and he watched as the car pulled up next to his. One of the officers exited the vehicle, walked up to the building to get the address, and then proceeds to write a traffic ticket, which he places underneath the windshield wipers. The time on the ticket is 2:05. At this point, the officer gets back in the car and they drive down the road, stopping twice more to write two more tickets. Now, supposedly, at least according to Maury Terry, and again, I don't have any way to verify this beyond what Maury Terry says, Berkowitz then goes over to the park and tells two individuals who are at the park that they need to call off the shooting as he has just been ticketed and this will make him susceptible to arrest. Apparently, Berkowitz loses this argument and heads back over to Bay 17th Street, where he is ordered to make certain that the police car has left the area. This is about 2:10 a.m. Between 2:10 and 2:30, a young girl is riding her bike through the neighborhood on 17th Avenue near Bath Avenue. She's roughly two blocks west of where Berkowitz's car is parked, and she's three blocks away from where Volante and Moskowitz are parked. According to this young girl, she notices a yellow car whose make she is unable to identify following her, and this car pulls up alongside her eventually, and the driver is staring at her. And the one thing that this young girl notices is that the driver is wearing sunglasses. And if you remember, one of the individuals who was seen inside the park was wearing sunglasses. Anyways, this girl gets to her house safely, although the car is reported to have sat outside for a few moments longer before heading off back in the direction of the park. Also in this time frame, Mrs. Cecilia Davis, who's a 49-year-old widow and a native of Austria, she is out with a friend of hers for the evening, and they are pulling down Bay 17th Street, looking for an area that they can park. They see Berkowitz's car with the ticket on it and decide not to stop there. They end up triple parking near Mrs. Davis's building, which is number 262. Sitting in the car, Mrs. Davis sees a young man emerge from a courtyard, go up to the Ford Galaxy, and remove the ticket from the windshield. She states that he is wearing a denim jacket and pants, at which point he puts the ticket inside of his car and then stands watching the police, who are still on the road further down from where they are. Mrs. Davis watches the young man for a few minutes as he gets into the car and drives off. Berkowitz, in the Galaxy, follows the police across the Cropsey Avenue intersection over to Bay 17th and Bath Avenues, at which point they both turn right. At this point, Mrs. Davis goes inside of her building. Roughly the same time that the Galaxy, driven by David Berkowitz, is leaving the area, Robert Volante and Stacy Moskowitz are inside the park, and as they walk down into the park along a path, they see a man standing beneath a broken park light. He's leaning against a restroom building, and according to Volante, he's a weird, grubby-looking hippie with dark hair that's curly and all messed up. It's down over his forehead. The individual is said to be stocky and wearing either a bluish denim shirt or a jacket with a t-shirt underneath. The man's sleeves are rolled up. He is unshaven, tanned, and has quote-unquote piercing dark eyes. They pass within a few feet of the man, making their way over to the area of the park where the swings are at, where they ride on the swings for roughly 5 minutes, returning to their car at roughly 2:25 a.m. As they leave the park, they do not see the man standing against the building. Now, multiple witnesses have corroborated this time frame, including Zeno, as well as another couple who were parked on the street. They saw both Volante and Stacy Moskowitz go into the park and then return a few minutes later. A few blocks away, at about 2:22, Mrs. Davis has taken her small dog, Snowball, outside for a walk. They head down the west side of Bay 17th Street, and she takes note of the fact that the Galaxy is no longer parked near the fire hydrant. She ends up over near the overpass, where she lets her dog free for a few minutes. Miss Davis notices three cars in the vicinity: Zeno's, Volante's, and what she termed a Volkswagen bus. At this point, it is roughly 2:30 a.m. It's roughly 2:33 a.m. by the time that Mrs. Davis and her dog return to her apartment building. At this point, she sees a man leaping the curb to the sidewalk on her side of the block. He appears to be coming from the other side of the road. Mrs. Davis would identify this man later as being David Berkowitz. According to Miss Davis, she did not connect him to the Galaxy that she had seen earlier. However, she said he was quote-unquote similar to him. According to Mrs. Davis, he's wearing a dark blue denim jacket with the sleeves rolled down. He's wearing a shiny gray colored shirt, which is tucked into his trousers. Miss Davis would later state that the man was so well kept looking, she believed that he was out on a date. She sees the man enter a courtyard between buildings and light glint off of something metallic that is partially hidden up his right sleeve jacket. Miss Davis becomes frightened at this point and hustles into her apartment. And no sooner is she inside and the dog unleashed that she grabs a newspaper and opens it that she hears gunshots go off. At roughly 2:35 a.m., while Mrs. Davis is still going into her apartment, Tommy Zeno sees a man standing by a bench near the park's entrance, which is across the street from him. It should be noted that by all accounts, the area that he was parked in was extremely well lit, with some sources stating that it was almost as bright as daylight out at that period of time. And Zeno stated that he got a very good look at the man, who was not moving. The man was said to be 25 to 30 years of age, short, about 5'7" tall, stocky, with long, straight, messy, blondish hair that was hanging over his forehead and part of his ears. Zeno later stated that it looked like a wig. The man is wearing a grayish uniform-type shirt with long sleeves that are rolled up to his elbows. The shirt was untucked from his pants, and the man was unshaven. Zeno observes the man looking both ways down the street before crossing over and approaching the Volante car. The blondish-haired man stops roughly 2 feet from the car, pulls a gun from beneath his shirt, crouches, and fires four times through the open passenger window. Zeno stated that he saw the man's go quote-unquote up and down between shots. At this point, the attacker stops firing, turns, and runs like hell into the darkened park and disappears. On the opposite side of the park, which is roughly 100 yards away, on the 17th Avenue side, a woman who is in a car with her boyfriend sees a white male with dark eyebrows who's possibly wearing a denim jacket and wearing a light-colored cheap nylon wig exit the park at a fast pace, enter a small light-colored auto, and leave. This woman, who is a beautician, thinks that the individual looks suspicious, so she tries to write down the license plate number. She gets down 4GUR or 4GVR. Other individuals on the 17th Avenue side see a car pull away from the park roughly 20 seconds after the shots were fired. One of these individuals was able to state that it was a yellow Volkswagen speeding north on 17th Avenue away from the park, and
this other individual is able to write down a partial plate. 463. At the corner of 17th Avenue and Cropsey, the yellow VW, its lights out, and with the driver's arm hanging out the window to hold the door closed, flies through a red light and nearly collides with a... Apparently, both cars stop in the intersection, and the driver of the VW leans out the window screaming, "Motherfucker," before straightening his own vehicle out and taking off west on Cropsey. The driver of the other vehicle swings a sharp U-turn and takes off in pursuit. At this point, the driver of the VW turns on his headlights, although realizing that the driver of the other car is following him, the driver of the Volkswagen turns the lights back off. A small chase ensues with the Volkswagen flipping a U-turn and coming back at the car that is chasing it. The person in the other vehicle also pulls a U-turn and follows the driver up onto the Belt Parkway. Unfortunately, the Volkswagen manages to escape. According to this individual, the man was male, white, 28 to 32 years old, high cheekbones, face narrow at the bottom, slight cleft in chin, flattish nose, shadowy, unshaven face, narrowish, very dark eyes, hair messy, stringy and brown, combed left to right. Also of note from this witness is that he noted that the individual driving the Volkswagen was wearing a grayish-colored blue long-sleeve shirt and that the sleeves were rolled up to the elbows, and he noticed this because the man's arm was hanging out the door of the car. While all of this was going on, back at the park, a woman inside of her apartment on 16th Bay Street, which faced the playground, heard cries for help, which belonged to Volante, and the sound of a car horn blaring, which was also Volante's. Looking out the window, she saw a man, later identified as David Berkowitz, walk casually out of the park's handball courts and continue to stroll across Bay 16th Street toward her building. Later, Berkowitz would say that he left the area by precisely the route that this woman had given. Another woman said she saw another car leave the scene in a highly suspicious manner. This woman lived on Bay 14th Street, which is the block adjacent to the park's western side. She was standing in front of her home when she saw a small yellow car with its headlights flashing on and off speed past her. As for Robert Volante and Stacy Moskowitz, the two of them were pretty heavily injured in the shooting. Volante leaned against the horn in order to try and get people's attention, after which point he climbed from the car, went to a street lamp and began screaming for help before returning to the car and pressing on the horn. Tommy Zeno, who was in his Corvette, realized what was happening and left the scene, driving over to a police precinct on Bath Avenue, at which point he informed a cop of what had happened before rushing back to the scene. Arriving, he saw Volante lying in the street and an off-duty police officer standing over him. Zeno and this off-duty officer placed a blanket over Volante. Meanwhile, Stacy was sprawled across the front seat of Valente's car. Later, the police commissioner stated that they had made a grave mistake in blanketing Queens and the Bronx, saying, quote-unquote, "We've got an entire city to protect now. Sam is telling us he can strike anywhere."
all of this is important as it goes against the official story put out by police that Berkowitz had done the shooting. And the reason I say this is because if you actually go and look at a map, and I will be posting one on the Instagram account, the area where Berkowitz was seen at the time of the shooting, there's a pretty good distance between where he was on Bay 17th Street and where Valente's car was parked. And I'm sorry, but there is no way he is sprinting New York City blocks to get over to the car in order to shoot the two victims in this very, very small time frame of a minute or two. A New York City block is extremely long. Anybody who's never been to New York City blocks are the kind of thing that can take you, 10 minutes to walk, let alone run. So, in order for Berkowitz to have been seen by Mrs. Davis and then get over to the park in enough time to shoot the individuals, he would have had to have been moving like the Flash. You couple that with witness statements of seeing the yellow VW leave the scene after the shooter opened fire, and then this other individual who gave chase to the VW because they almost hit him, and the inconsistencies of descriptions between what Berkowitz was wearing, how his shirt sleeves were all the way down, and the shooter's shirt sleeves being stated as being rolled up, it's pretty obvious that there was another individual or individuals on scene at the time of the shooting. Another important part from this shooting is that the police made two sketches from it, although the one that they released to the public was a composite of the two different sketches, made up mostly of the man that Mrs. Davis saw, who was David Berkowitz. And tests were done to see how long it was that it took Mrs. Davis to make her walk after her friend left, and when she saw Berkowitz duck between the buildings, and then when the shots began to fire. Now, according to Maury Terry, when she saw Berkowitz go between the buildings, 1 minute and 10 seconds elapsed before the shots were fired. How true this is, I'm not certain, but again, having been to New York City and actually lived there for a year, he would have had to have been moving at a speed that no human could achieve in order to get from where he was seen to where the shooting took place at in such a short amount of time. As for the victims, Stacy Moskowitz would eventually succumb to her injuries, while Robert Valente would lose the sight of one eye. At first, the Omega Task Force tried to downplay it was the Son of Sam who was responsible, as this killing had taken place outside of his established hunting grounds. But it soon became pretty apparent that the Son of Sam had indeed been involved in this murder. So what happened next was that the task force went into overdrive, and they were specifically looking for a yellow Volkswagen. They also decided to check with the police who were in the area handing out tickets that evening to see if they had given out any in the general vicinity of the shooting. Initially, the police officers stated that they could not recall whether or not they had, in fact, written any parking tickets. And it would be Mrs. Davis that let the police know that summons had, in fact, been written, at which point the police began looking in earnest, and they found them on August 8th. But before that, on August 2nd, Mrs. Davis finally came forward to the police, who were in the process of questioning Tommy Zeno. And it was from all this that the police began to put together the story that they felt had happened that night. Interestingly, this is the period of time in the murders that they decided there was only one individual who was probably responsible, and they began looking for that individual. On the night of August 9th, Detective James Justice was trying to track down the cars which had been ticketed on the night of the Moskowitz shooting, and he ended up calling the Yonkers Police Department. Long story short, he was talking to an operator in the Yonkers department when he stated he was looking for an individual who had been ticketed the night of the murders, one David Berkowitz, at which point the operator stated, quote-unquote, "Oh no, oh no." Justice said, "Do you know him?" The operator said, "Could I? I was very involved. This is the guy I think is responsible." Justice: "David Berkowitz?" Operator: "Is responsible. My father was down there yesterday, Saturday." Justice: "Yeah?" Operator: "And you also got information is he at 35 Pine Street?" Justice: "Yes, dear." Operator: "David Berkowitz. I don't know how you or what you, but my father went down to the 109th, and you also. Someone received information through our police offices, and that's because of some incidents involved shooting where we have reason to believe this person is responsible. He also has written similar type threatening letters to the sheriff's investigator who recently moved into his apartment. So I don't." Justice: "Do you know David Berkowitz yourself?" Operator: "I don't know him. I really, because of the shooting incident at my home and a fire bombing and threatening letters." The long and short of this is, the operator was a young woman by the name of Wheat Carr, and yes, that is her first name. This family had some interesting naming for their children. One of their sons' middle names was Wheat, which I don't quite understand. That her family had been contacting police because Berkowitz had shot one of their dogs because of its barking, firebombed, sent threatening letters to the house, as well as sent threatening letters to a police officer who lived in his building, and they had all contacted the Yonkers police over this. So this is how Berkowitz ended up getting on the task force's radar. Before we get into what happened next, however, just quickly, I am going to go over the Carr family. And the daughter, Wheat, the family patriarch, a man by the name of Sam Carr, a mother and two sons. One, a 24-year-old freelance advertising stylist, photographer, and designer by the name of Michael. And the other, John Carr, who at this point was 30 years old. I'm not going to dive too deeply into the Carr family at this point. I'm going to save that for the next episode. But just be aware that they do play into this story further. And it wasn't just that Berkowitz was harassing them, or that he had taken his name from Sam Carr, because Sam Carr owned a dog, which is the one that Berkowitz would later claim was talking to him. So, the police would later give an account that as soon as all of this information came in concerning Berkowitz and his war with the Carr family, they were immediately on top of it. They were suspicious, checking him out. The reality is, that isn't true. His name was just another in a long list of many who were potential suspects, and it wasn't until the next day that they actually sent two police officers out to Yonkers to check out David Berkowitz. So, the next day, August 10th, Detectives Ed Zigo and John Longo drove to Yonkers to look into David Berkowitz, eventually arriving on Pine Street, where they located Berkowitz's Galaxy, roughly 25 yards from number 35 Pine Street, which was the apartment building that Berkowitz lived in. This next bit is kind of odd in that the two detectives went over and looked into the car. Inside, in the back seat, they saw a duffel bag with a rifle butt sticking up out of the bag. And this is where it's odd, and it's one of the bits of information that is sometimes glossed over as being irrelevant. The police had no warrant to search David Berkowitz's vehicle, or to even enter it. However, Detective Zigo decided to climb inside of Berkowitz's car and look around, which is technically a violation of his civil rights, because it's an illegal search. Again, it's a piece that's often kind of glanced over in what happened after this, but the reality is that the police's case could have and should have been thrown out against David Berkowitz because of that officer's actions, regardless of whether or not they could have caught a serial murderer because of it. They illegally entered his vehicle, searched it, and later seized it. He would state that he did this because of the gun that was sticking out. Unfortunately for the police, reality is, I don't know what the laws are now, but back at that point, New York City, owning a rifle, semi-automatic, such as this one was not illegal, so they really had no reason to enter the vehicle. Looking around the car, Detective Zigo looked inside of the glove compartment and found a letter that was addressed to Omega Commander Timothy Dowd and the Suffolk County Long Island Police. Supposedly, the missive was a letter from the Son of Sam promising another attack. Interestingly enough, this particular letter did not match the style of the other two. And by style, I mean the handwriting as well as the cadence or natural writing ability that the other two letters had contained. After the police discovered the weapon in Berkowitz's car as well as the letter, other police began to arrive in the area. At this point, it was pretty much just a stakeout because beyond the illegally obtained letter, they had no evidence to arrest Berkowitz with. At some point during all of this, the volunteer sheriff's officer, Craig Glassman, the man that Berkowitz had been sending threatening letters to and lighting fires in front of the door of, came downstairs and the police spoke with him. And eventually it was decided that he would be their best chance at identifying Berkowitz. Remember, at this point, they didn't even know what he looked like. So they ended up kind of hanging out and staking out the area. At roughly 10 p.m., on August 10th, Berkowitz, with a .44 caliber bulldog wrapped inside of a brown paper sack, exited the building and walked down to the Galaxy and got inside. While he was attempting to get the car started, the police moved in with one detective standing on either side of the car pointing their guns at him. So this was really a split decision on the point of the detectives, as again,
They had no legal reason to arrest him, yet they decided, you know what, we need to do this anyways. So they arrested Berkowitz, who was reportedly smiling in a kind of dreamlike manner when they took him out of the car. And in fact, you can find footage online of Berkowitz when he was brought into the police headquarters. And he has this very eerie smile on his face, and he almost looks like he's drugged or high on something because his eyes are at half-mast. And naturally, this made news not just in New York, but all around the country, that the police had taken a man that was believed to be the son of Sam into custody. I am going to leave the story here this week with the arrest of David Berkowitz. We will pick it back up next week, where we'll go through his trial and the aftermath, and I will also dive into the conspiracy theory that Maury Terry came up with, which many believe to be fact. Couple of quick plugs at this point. A friend of mine, friend of the show, an author by the name of Alistair Cross, has just released a new novel, and I know it's doing fairly well. The third book in his Crimson Cove series of vampire novels called The Black Wasp. And while I have not yet had a chance to read it, it is getting excellent reviews across the board. And it's available on Amazon and Kindle. Again, that's The Black Wasp by Alistair Cross. And it should be out on audiobook here in the next few months. So if you're into that kind of thing, I can't recommend Alistair's work enough. Before I get out of here, I need to remind you that The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next week, stay safe and stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.